Good morning, everybody. This morning, we're really excited to have Elizabeth Dunn here. She has been a presenter for us at this seminar for years now. And Elizabeth has a PhD in Ag Economics from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And today, she's going to present on some research that we've done over the last couple of years. And this research is funded by our field LWA and FHI 360, so we want to thank them. And the research focuses on something that we've been asking about value chain development for some time. To what extent do smallholders participate in value chains? To what extent are they investing in upgrading or improving their productivity? And to what extent are they benefiting from this participation and investment? And to a significant extent, I think this research focuses on scaling. USAID these days is very focused on scaling impacts and scaling technologies. And I think that this research not only focuses on the extent of scaling that we're seeing in terms of outreach or extent of impact or scaling of impact in terms of productivity, but it's looking at not just the tangible things that are needed to achieve scale, but also the intangible. What kind of decision making is going on behind decisions to invest or participate? And what are some of the incentives that are needed to achieve the kind of scaling that people are looking for? So with that, let me turn it over to you.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the introduction, Jean, and I want to thank QED for hosting this event as well as FHI 360 for sponsoring the research. And I want to also thank ACD Iwoka for their long collaboration, and of course, USAID's IMPEP office that makes it all possible. So, you know, USAID has a long history of working in agriculture, and in recent years, there have been several years of experience working to integrate smallholders into competitive agricultural value chains. Oh, you can go. Yeah, there you go. And more recently, USAID's Feed the Future initiative has reaffirmed the importance of investing in smallholder agriculture as a means for reducing poverty and hunger in rural areas. So I think it's important for us to consider then, what are the factors that might affect the success of this strategy? While we know there are large numbers of smallholders in rural areas, we shouldn't expect that all of them are going to be likely to contribute to accelerating growth in the agricultural sector. So this talk is about, you know, who might participate and who might not. The seminar is going to focus on three important questions about smallholder participation. And the first question is about scale. The question here is, how many smallholders can be reached through agricultural value chain projects? And correlated to those questions are, you know, what are some of the factors that affect scale of outreach? And what can we learn about good ways to go to scale and to integrate large numbers of smallholders? The second question relates to productivity. And it asks, if smallholders are reached by agricultural value chain projects, then what do we know about their ability to increase their productivity? When will smallholders be willing to make those investments that are required to improve productivity? The third question has to do with benefits. When smallholders do adopt new practices and improve their agricultural productivity, then what happens to farm profits and to household income? You know, do smallholders benefit from this participation? So I'll spend a little bit more time on scale and productivity, a little bit less on benefits because the evidence is stronger for the first two. But the entire discussion is going to be framed in terms of the smallholder as decision makers, and upgrading and productivity and participation as decisions, as outcomes of a smallholder decision process. So that way we can look at the conditions that affect smallholder outcomes related to scale, productivity, and benefits. Before I forget, I want to let everybody know that the material for this seminar is in a publication, and there are lots of copies here. Give a little shout out to the people online, because I'm usually online since I live out of town. And there you should be able to download this report from Microlinks. All right. So here's the agenda for the presentation, basically two parts. As a brief background, I want to tell you about the 12 cases that are included in the study. And then I want to introduce the framework for understanding smallholder decision making. And after briefly touching on this background material, then I want to focus on those three issues of scale, productivity, and benefits. And for each one, I'll show you some of the evidence that's in the paper, some of the evidence that we found in the cases, and then try to interpret those findings in terms of that decision-making framework. Okay? So let's look at the cases that provide the evidence for the study. Nice. As I mentioned, there are 12 agricultural value chains included in the study, and there's also was a handout on your chair, and these 12 cases are listed on the table one of the handout. Of these, 10 are related to donor projects, and the other two are not part of a recent donor project. They're just kind of a point of reference of what's out there. There are four donors represented: USAID, DFID, MCC, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And the projects themselves vary quite a bit in terms of, for example, project budgets range from under $5 million to over $62 million. And the lengths of the projects range from 3 to 8 years. So there's quite a bit of variation in these projects. They cover several types of value chains, including maize, smallholder dairy, several types of high-value horticultural products, as well as agricultural inputs. So those are kind of the four types of value chains in the study. And it's also one more thing I want to point out about the 12 cases is that I used a variety of evidence, and I pulled together a variety of evidence. You might call it apples and oranges, but it is all of the 10 donor projects had monitoring data, so I used that. 7 of those projects had longitudinal impact evaluations, of which some were quasi-experimental and some were experimental. So I used that information. And in addition to that, one of the cases, the evidence came from an application of the DCED evaluation standard. So that's interesting. And then there were a couple of other miscellaneous studies, cross-sectional studies, cross-country studies that I used, that I pulled data from. And those are all referenced in the paper. Okay. This slide introduces the framework that I want to use for understanding the context within which smallholders make their decisions. And the factors that influence smallholder decisions are divided into two categories: opportunities and capabilities. So opportunities reflect the characteristics of the market and the business-enabling environment. These are the market opportunities that provide the incentives to invest, the pull factors that motivate behavior change. And the primary question that a smallholder would ask him or herself about market opportunities are, is this opportunity worth it? And I'm an economist, so of course the second question has to be, is this better than my next best alternative? Okay. Capabilities, on the other hand, reflect the resources, skills, and characteristics of the farm and the household. These are the push factors, and they correspond to the household, smallholder asking him or herself the questions of, am I able to do it? And do I have sufficient knowledge, resources, and skills? You should come sit over here because you won't be able to see the presentation. Okay. Sorry. And one thing that's really important to keep in mind, it'll help you as we go through, is to realize that opportunities apply to a market or a geographic region as a whole, whereas capabilities are distributed unevenly over the smallholder population, okay? So meaning that smallholders are heterogeneous with respect to characteristics such as the size of their land holding, the levels of their food security and corresponding risk tolerances, as well as their own level of knowledge and skills and their access to information, okay? So I want to use this framework then, after presenting the evidence for each one, I'll use this framework to try to interpret some of the findings. So let's turn then to the first topic, which is scale. And this is a really cool chart, and it shows the scale of outreach for 9 agricultural value chain projects. I want to point out that the light blue bar at the bottom does not represent a value chain project. It represents the number of smallholders producing high-value vegetables in Guatemala and in the value chain and not part of a project. So it's kind of a point of reference for the other information. And all of the dark blue lines, on the other hand, do represent project outreach. And the first conclusion that I'd like to draw you to is that it is possible for agricultural value chain projects to reach hundreds of thousands of smallholders. Okay. But I know it's very tempting to try to compare these lines to each other and say, well, why did this project reach this many and this other project not as many? And I want to point out a few things that you need to keep in mind to kind of temper that urge to compare. And the first thing is you have to know that this is scale only. This is not benefits. Okay? So it's quite possible that a project that reaches a smaller number of smallholders delivers many, many more times the benefits to them. So scale doesn't tell the whole story. Some of these variations in scale can be understood in terms of differences in the projects, such as the length of the projects, which I said varied from 3 to 8 years, or the budgets, which varied from $5 to $62 million. And in some cases, the smaller scale is just due to exogenous shocks that created, unexpected limitations on the outreach of the project. And last but not least, I think it's important to understand that some of these differences in scale can be related to the program approach. A facilitation approach that works indirectly with farmers through other market actors, such as input suppliers and lead buyers and processing plants, they have the potential to reach a relatively large number of farmers. So the four bars at the top represent projects, are all from projects that use primarily a facilitation approach. I want to say a little bit about project outreach, because in fact, in looking at the data that I used, there were differences, and you'll see in the paper, there are differences in the kind of outreach that each project reported on, because there are 3 possible types of project outreach, and this figure illustrates those. A direct delivery approach is associated with 2 types of outreach to smallholders. First, farmers are reached as direct contacts of a project. In other words, they're the direct recipients of program-sponsored goods and services. In addition, there's another type of outreach, and those would be the farmers who imitate the direct contacts. And these in the diagram are called spillovers. Okay, that's just the name I chose. As I mentioned on the previous slide, a facilitation approach usually has limited direct contact with farmers, but instead works through other market actors who have commercial relationships with the farmers. And in this way, farmers are reached as indirect contacts. Okay. There can be 2 types of spillover in this kind of a situation. First, the kind I mentioned before, where farmers imitate other farmers. That's one kind of spillover. But there's also spillover among the larger firms as well, when a firm recognizes that, hey, their competitor is actually making money off of working with smallholders, and then that's another type of imitation or spillover. And one of the principles of facilitation is actually to really emphasize this demonstration effect in order to attract large numbers of imitators. So if we think about farmers that might be reached directly through facilitation as the tip of an iceberg, then the farmers reached indirectly and through spillover are the much larger submerged part of the iceberg. Okay. This is an interesting figure, and actually it's not in the paper. So you'll have to go back to the presentation slides if you want to get this figure again. And it comes from the Kenya maize case and illustrates the results on scale over time. That is, how did scale accumulate over time? The Kenya maize case was the longest of the projects, lasting 8 years. In this case, it's the number, the graph reflects the number of farmers using improved seeds and fertilizers over time. And there are a couple of important things to note about this. First, you can see that outreach is very slow to start with in the first 2 or 3 years. But then it reaches a point where it starts to rise steeply when there's kind of a tipping point reached in the process. This pattern is considered, we don't have a lot of evidence and we're trying to accumulate that, but this pattern is considered typical for outreach under facilitation. And one of the things that it implies then is that we should have realistic expectations of the level of outreach in the first few years of a facilitation project. So what are some of the minimum conditions that need to be in place for smallholder participation? Under capabilities, the first bullet relates to smallholder resources. And for example, we know that there are many smallholders in Africa who have land holdings that are just too tiny to be economically viable. Again, remembering capabilities are unevenly distributed over the smallholders. The second bullet highlights that food security needs are paramount and that the household, that these needs have to be met before a household is going to be willing to make investments in new, more risky alternatives. The third bullet refers to awareness and information, and we know that these things vary across households. Under opportunities, the first two bullets refer to the presence of buyers and the availability of appropriate inputs. And the third one, BEE, stands for Business Enabling Environment. And an example of how the business enabling environment can permit market access, there's an example of that from the India vegetables case, where a law that had previously required all smallholders to sell into the wholesale markets was reversed, allowing smallholders for the first time to participate in more competitive agricultural value chains. It's just like a basic minimum requirement. I want to turn now to the topic of productivity. In the value chain literature, upgrading is defined as investment that increases value added. And it's these upgrading investments, these upgrading decisions made by smallholders that are the foundation for productivity growth in agriculture. There are actually 5 types of upgrading that are defined in the value chain literature, but we're going to focus on 2 that are relevant here, process and product upgrading. The type of upgrading that improves efficiency is called process upgrading, and it can result in higher yields, it can result in lower costs, or it can result in both of them happening at the same time. The type of upgrading that improves product quality is called product upgrading. And there's some examples of upgrading, not examples, but the types of categories of upgrading listed on the slide, and those include, cultivating new crop varieties, adopting new technological production technology packages, and attaining new levels of food safety. The important point to remember here is that productivity gains depend on upgrading, and upgrading is a decision made by the smallholder. Therefore, if we want to improve productivity in smallholder agriculture, we have to understand what motivates or possibly discourages smallholders from making these investments. You see, you can refer to Table 2 in the handout for data here. I didn't want to try to put Table 2 up on a slide. But the evidence does show that smallholders are capable of significant productivity gains and that they will change their technical and business practices in order to boost yields, lower costs, and improve quality. So what I've done is I've picked 3 examples of productivity growth, and you can find others in Table 2. In the case of Kenya Dairy, some 90,000 smallholders were reached and adopted or received new genetic strains. New bovine genetic strains through artificial insemination. And that resulted in milk yields that increased by 19% and cost reductions unit cost reductions on the level of 16%. So the smallholder dairy farmers made more profits. In Zambia, agrochemical and seed suppliers work through networks of sales agents to increase the use of improved inputs by smallholder households. And the result of that was a 70 to 80% increase in maize production. In Nigeria, fertilizer was sold in small packets through a rural sales network, resulting in increased fertilizer use by smallholders and an increased yield in maize, sorghum, and rice with an overall productivity increase of 15%. These and other examples listed in the table, as you read about the examples, they provide insights about the conditions that promote and hinder upgrading. And so let's look at some of those conditions that need to be in place for smallholders to invest in new technologies and new products and boost their productivity. As before, these conditions are organized into opportunities and capabilities. And under capabilities, the second bullet emphasizes the need for investment capital. Lack of capital can be a critical constraint since upgrading requires investment. The needed capital might come from a variety of sources, including savings, credit, or other income streams of the household. In agricultural market systems, in-kind credit offered through other value chain actors, such as the product buyer, can be an important source of capital for productivity-enhancing investments. Examples of under opportunities, I want to give examples of business infrastructure that lowers costs include things such as farm-to-market roads and utilities, information communication technology, and also investments that lower the cost of meeting food safety requirements. An example of that comes from Kenya, where USAID facilitated a project to create Kenya Gap, which then provided a lower cost way for smallholders to meet European food safety standards. All right. I'm going to go from productivity to the question of benefits. In the cases that were reviewed for the study, benefits are defined in terms of farm profits and household income. As we know, these variables, household income, are located near the end of the impact pathway that connects, adopting new technologies, increasing productivity, getting higher farm profits, and then higher income. So these are closer to the development objective of reducing poverty. And what we find is that while 5 of the 10 cases show evidence of positive impacts on farm profits, there is much less evidence showing positive impacts on household income. Okay. There are some important exceptions to this statement, and I do want to point these out. They include the findings from a longitudinal cross-country study that overlapped with the 3 Kenya cases. And in that study, of course, that was done a little bit later as well. In that study, they found that poverty rates for smallholders reached both directly and indirectly fell significantly more than did poverty rates for the control groups. Okay. Another exception comes from the case of Nigeria Fertilizer, where crop income for participating households increased 30 to 40%, and household income also increased 32%. So in that case, productivity, farm profits and household income tracked with each other. But in the other cases, they don't. And in general, the impact evaluations found evidence of higher profits, but not higher incomes. And these findings are consistent with results published by MCC, based on the result of 5 randomized control trials of farmer training programs. And they showed significant gains in enterprise income, but not in household income. So how can this be? Is this puzzling? I hope it's puzzling to some people, because it was puzzling to me when I first saw it. In fact, it was really hard at first when I started out to do this paper. Before I separated these two variables, I couldn't make sense about what I was finding. So there are several possible explanations for this inconsistent finding. And one set of explanations focuses on problems with evaluation practice. Okay, and I think this is very important in the MCC report. They also pointed this out. First of all, for example, our evaluation horizons are too short in length. As we saw that curve where scale didn't even start until almost year three, if we have a three-year project and we evaluate impacts at the end of it, we might be missing. We might be missing something. The other thing is that evaluation designs are not quite flexible in many cases to kind of keep track with the dynamic context in which we're operating. So there are various problems related to evaluation. But there's a second set of explanations, and it revolves around really taking a close look at our assumptions about the impact pathway that connects project interventions to poverty reduction. You know, these receiving outreach from the project, making a decision to upgrade, boosting productivity, getting higher farm profit, getting higher household income, these are all a sequence of events, and they can break down at any point. And I think that's really one of the important things to take away here, is knowing that these links can break down at any step of the way. It leads us then to question our assumption that increased productivity will automatically lead to higher income. This slide shows some of the conditions that influence smallholder benefits. And when you look at the conditions, you'll notice that the emphasis is on information, awareness, transparency, and relationships between firms, including vertical and horizontal relationships. Smallholders need access to information in order to improve farm and household income. The business enabling environment can play an important role of leveling the playing field by promoting standards, transparency, and wide accessibility of markets, information, and other types of information. And in my opinion, this is a pretty low-cost intervention, relatively speaking. All right. This is my last slide. And it summarizes some of these results, so I want to reiterate a few of the things that I've said. Under scale, we saw that a large number of smallholders can be reached through indirect contact using facilitation approaches. Under productivity, we focused on upgrading as an investment decision, and we saw that strong market incentives are a necessary but not sufficient condition for upgrading and productivity growth. On benefits, we saw that the higher enterprise profits don't automatically imply higher household income, which raised several questions on evaluation practice, and as well reminds us that we need to question that assumption that improved productivity will automatically lead to poverty reduction. And I want to emphasize that in order to realize the full potential of smallholder-led agricultural growth, it's critical for us to understand the behavioral piece, to understand that smallholders make decisions based in response to market opportunities and based on their own individual capabilities. And if we want to identify which smallholders are most likely to contribute to agricultural growth, then we have to consider both the pull of the market forces and the push of the household capabilities. Knowledge about the distribution of capabilities over the target population can generate more realistic expectations about scale, and provide a more nuanced understanding of the factors that encourage or constrain smallholder outreach, productivity growth, and income benefits. And those are my comments. Thank you.